Roger Bush, Reel 3. Yes, you were explaining your contacts with the organisation, weren't you?
Yes, so that was the organisation in Hanover. We also went, again, a mixed group of international volunteers, German students and refugees, to work on one of the East Friesian islands. And this was not for very long, but it was partly regarded as a bit of a holiday for some of the refugees, although this was still fairly early in the year and the weather was not all that clement. But anyway, we were told in Ostfriesland they all speak Plattdeutsch by our German hosts, that this was very like English, so you will understand them. And then we set off to Yust, which you reach by a ferry from the North German port of Nordijk. And Yust, I should say, is not much more than a sandbank. And the work we had was concerned with the youth hostel on the island, which had a problem. The encroaching sand dunes would regularly bury it, and it was our job to dig it out. And so all week we would labour at this, and then at the weekend a storm would spring up and drive all the sand back onto the site. And I remember saying we were helpless as the European philosophers that William Blake railed at, you know, mock on, mock on, Voltaire, Rousseau, mock on, tis all in vain. We throw the sand against the wind and the wind blows it back again. Perhaps, in fact, we might have been better trying to stabilize the dunes with marine grass or any of these modern methods or even with netting. But anyway, after a couple of weeks, we were well disposed to see the world in a grain of sand. But and as for the Plattdeutsch, I'm sorry to say we were never able to test that out, because we've met very few natives. And those we did meet were so taciturn that it was impossible to hear what they were really saying. But maybe, again, that was to do with the wind.
This period would have been after the non-fraternisation rule, I imagine, would it? 1954?
Yes, there was none of that at this point. And, in fact, the next period of our time in Germany was one of exclusively fraternisation, because we went to stay with various German families. This was all again part of the general feeling that such moves helped to build up international understanding. And I was very fortunate in that I was billeted with a German family in Goslar, on the edge of the Harz Mountains. Lovely old town, very nice family. Two school-age children who were very good company until they had to go back to school. I made myself popular with the family because I discovered by great good luck that I could get them a supply of Nescafe. And Nescafe, I might say, was like gold dust in Germany at that time. I could get it from the Naffy. By a bit of sweet talking, and this was very helpful to them. The other good thing I can remember is that walking in the Harz Mountains was very pleasant, but the Harz Mountains were divided by the border between east and west, and none of the paths were waymarked, so you had to be very careful that you didn't stray across and run into border guards.
Would it have been quite a tense time regarding East-West relations? You know, 1954, that would be the year after Stalin died, wouldn't it?
It certainly was a tense time, and indeed, I heard a story, I don't know whether this is entirely true, about a refugee worker who had been on a walk, such as the ones I went on, who had accidentally strayed across the ploughed strip into the eastern sector, where he was arrested by a couple of border guards and taken to some abandoned farm buildings and locked in a cellar there, and really thought he was for it, whereupon they brought him up from the cellar, took him into the kitchen, faced him with a huge pile of potatoes which he was required to peel. When he had peeled them, they were sent, they sent him back over the border. So he said border guards didn't have a sense of humour.
Was one of the aims of the international service reconciliation and, you know, increasing understanding?
Well, that's an interesting question, because when the international service was set up, a large part of its aim was to encourage contacts between people from England and people particularly from Germany. And Jack Eglon, the first General Secretary of the International Service and its founder, actually wrote this into its the reasons for setting it up. In the early days, for instance, at Petersfield, there were quite a number of Germans who came across to work in this country. There was quite a lot of agricultural labouring went on from Petersfield. So, yes, that was part of the original aims of international service. I think these had changed slightly by the time I was working in it, because Jack Eglon went at the beginning of 1950, and Jack Norton was an altogether more pragmatic, perhaps less idealistic person, but at the same time he was better for the unit at that time. He was the sort of person who needed, who was needed to give it the shove in the right direction and to cope with the rather precarious finances, because at that stage, in the late 1940s up to 1950, quite a proportion of the unit's finances came from subscriptions. Quakers and others during the war had agreed to donate money over a period, and this period extended beyond the end of the war. So money was coming in from subscriptions, but it was falling off rapidly, and another way of existence had to be found. That was what Jack Norton did, I think, in 1950-51. But it meant that the international service really took a slightly different direction.
The German students that you were working with, you know, were you achieving good understanding with them, would you say?
Yes, I think they were genuinely keen on the whole idea of internationalism. There's a sort of work camp ethic which I think kicks in all these situations, and for instance, I remember we all used to sit around and sing these songs, and we were supposed to come up with some English folk songs, and of course Germany is full of folk songs. Folk songs are a great work camp thing. So we got to learn quite a few of those. One of my friends who was in France actually compiled a book of songs sung at work camps. And since he then went on to teach languages, found it very useful.
Well, was there much talk about the war and, you know, Nazism in your discussions with these young people?
Oddly enough, I don't remember any of that in my time in North Germany. Although we visited the homes of several young Germans in Hanover, I don't think the war came much into it. I do remember earlier than that, because I had been to Germany before my experience in the FAU, and met up with a group of young Germans then. As we were going to a dance, some of them had begun singing the Horst Wessel song, and some of the girls I was with were terribly embarrassed by this, and did their utmost to excuse the the boorish conduct of their fellows. But since I was not acquainted with the horse vessel, so it didn't mean a lot to me.
You were saying they weren't very hard working, though, the students. You know, they didn't put their backs into the hard graft.
Well, of course, in any situation where you've got an international workforce, it's not actually very good at doing the work. And in some ways, a situation like that can impair international relations by encouraging the building of national stereotypes. The Germans talked a lot and didn't actually put their hands to the shovel very much. The French were awkward. If the weather was at all bad, they were against working. The Italians were very cheerful, hard working, but often didn't understand much of the discussion. So, in a way, these racial stereotypes were rather reinforced than diminished by working together. I think this is a difficulty with any international workforce.
Yes, I suppose this, you know, indicates that one can have the high aims, but in reality it doesn't always work out, you know, of having a genuine reconciliation and understanding.
I think possibly with more discussion, which would have been facilitated if more of us understood German, for instance.
I was going to ask you about the language, you know, if there was problems.
Yes, my knowledge of German was not that good. It was barely above school German. I had spent some time in Germany there, so I had a little more than some of the others. I think really the trouble was that, as I say, we didn't get the point of discussing global politics or anything like that. We were really concerned with much more local problems. The problems of Hanover, the problems with the transport system, the problems with accommodation, and because of the particular camp we were at, the problems of merely existing because the diet and the weather was so bad.
How much support would you have had from the UK, from Melksham, you know, when you were out in the field? Did people come to check on you, your welfare, and to see that, you know, the job was working out?
In earlier days, I'm fairly sure that the General Secretary, both Jack Eglon and Jack Norton, came on regular visits to visit these sections. By the time we were into this fairly short-term work in North Germany, I don't think such a visit would have been possible. On the other hand, support was available from headquarters and, for instance, over this matter of the diet. I managed to get my small section, a small extra allowance to supplement the rations.
Right, so does this take us to the end of your experience then?
Yes, the last part of our experience in Germany was our hospitality with German families. And so when I left Goslar and the comfortable apartment which I shared with the German family I was sent to, I was given instructions to proceed to France, and I was to meet up with another of the international service people who had been elsewhere in Germany, and we were to go together to Paris and on to join a community. I knew very little about this community because I hadn't actually come into contact with members who had worked at its previous home, which was in another part of France, not far from Auxerre. They had left that property and were now installed in a chateau in the Loire Valley, which sounds very grand, and indeed it was a grand chateau, but it was bit run down, and there was a lot of work both in the building and in its surroundings to bring them back into production. I need to say a little bit about the community at Avray.
Avray.
Which was mainly based on two linked families, the Apps and the Schultzes, who, as you may gather, came from the eastern part of France. The Schultzes were, in fact, Alsatian. And the Apps had links to Switzerland. Henri Schultz was known generally as Le Père, the father of the community, had set it up with the idea that you could engage in this kind of communal existence with a quasi-religious pacifist objective. It would take in on board anybody who really wanted to come and work there. The work they had to. The work was very hard, in fact. But the community spirit was very good. When they were at Chancellerie, Jack Norton had been over to visit the first people who were sent to work with this community. And he was very impressed by their self-sufficiency. Jack, I should say, was particularly in his early years in the FAU, very keen on building self-sufficiency into the unit itself, so that the headquarters kept pigs, poultry, had an extensive garden, and in fact produced most of the food it consumed. So he was quite into self-sufficiency, and he could see that that was what Henri Schultz and his community was trying to do in rural France, with a great deal more difficulty there. At Avray, one of the projects was to establish an international camping site in the grounds, the owner having agreed to this, and so part of the work was the physical labour of laying a water pipeline to the meadows below the castle. The other work was mainly concerned with refurbishing the castle, a lot of redecorating, the cleaning and polishing of really quite elegant parquet floors in both the salons, and the bringing into use of a huge number of bedrooms. The reason for this soon became obvious, because no sooner had the school holidays started, then not one but two colony de vacances descended on the castle, and the place was alive with young teenage girls, which was very welcome for those of us on the section. And many of them had been sent there because, of course, their parents or many of the parents were North African families, and we're talking about the time when there was a lot of trouble in Algeria, and in fact, if you went into the local towns, you could hear the car horns trotting out the refrain, Algerie, France, and it was a difficult time if you were young in Algeria, so many of the schoolgirls from there were sent to his colony in metropolitan France.
What work were the FAU doing there in the chateau?
The FAU were again doing the general labour that they reckoned to supply almost anywhere they worked. So it was gardening, excavations for the Puyo, for the camping site. It was quite a lot of building work and decorating to repair the fabric of the castle.
Is that what you were doing yourself, Roger? Your own work?
Was I spent quite a lot of time in the garden there, yes. I also worked with a decorator, a frightful fellow called René, who persisted in addressing me in very bad German. Incidentally, some of the members of the community, being Alsatians, chose to address me in German rather than French, on the grounds that having just come from Germany, I would have a better grasp of that language than I did of French, which was a mistake. Yes, a lot of the time I spent working in the gardens, as a result of which I had a very large French vocabulary concerned with vegetables and weeds and so on, but not very much on the urban front.
There was a lot of work done in France, I believe, by the International Service, wasn't there?
In the early years of the International Service, they did a great deal of work with the organisations, and this was part of the original culture of the International Service. Jack Eglon, as I've said, was very keen on contacts between young people internationally, so that nearly all the work undertaken by the International Service in France in the early days was concerned with catering for orphaned children, handicapped children, and children who'd suffered in one way or another because of the activities of the war, and in association with various French organisations.
So, was this the end of your service, the French? Would that have been the end?
I finished my 2 years at the time I was actually in France. So when I came back from France, it was simply to go to headquarters and sign off. I hadn't actually, at that stage, accomplished the whole of my national service because it was slightly longer than 2 years. So for much of the remainder of the time, I went back on a private basis to work again for Leslie Kirkley in Oxford.
Oh, this was your second spell that you described earlier. Yes, right. Well, you know, when you consider your international service, you know, as a CO, was it satisfied? Were you able to do what you had wanted to do in this period?
Well, in some ways it was disappointing because the international side of it was relatively slight. In other ways, it was satisfying because of its variety. It certainly brought me into contact with all sorts of forms of work that I would never, in any circumstances, have undertaken. I think I've learned quite a lot in a fairly painless way during my time in FAUIS. I learned how to pace myself in straightforward physical work. I learned something about the way hospitals work and their hierarchy. I learned the sort of gulf there was between what people sitting in this country thought was happening in Europe and what was actually happening. There was a big gap between perception and reality. I learned a little bit about the rest of Europe, which I probably wouldn't have gained otherwise. And I learned that you could get along in a group where there were both idealists and practical people. They both had their reasons for existence, you know, and both were useful. They were both part of the picture. So I think these are all things that, you know, it can take you a very long time to discover unless you were faced with a situation where you had to do these 2 years. Could I have spent them in some other way? I'm really not sure. My brother, for instance, 18 months older than I, had an interview to join the International Service and decided it was not for him, and I think they also decided he was not for them, but in any case he went away and spent the whole of his time on a single job, He was a research chemist, mind you, so he spent most of the time working at Hammersmith Hospital, which actually advanced his career as well.
So he was a CO as well, would he have been?
He was a CO
yes.
as well, so he would have had to attend a tribunal, although I don't think I ever asked him about that.
How do you think your experience compared with, say, a national serviceman? Would you have? Do you think you? It was more creative. That you probably would have gained more by doing what you did. Do you have any idea?
The main impression I get from people who did their national service in the armed forces depends very much on where they were sent. Some people I know gained quite a lot from it because they, an old school friend of mine, now a photographer, spent some time in the Middle East, which he found very useful in later life because he became a stills photographer with films and in fact did the stills photographs for David Lean's film Lawrence of Arabia. But I think also many of them found their time in the forces very boring. Now, bits of the work of the international service were also boring, but on the whole, I think we did rather better in that regard.
How do you think, you know, I know you've been to reunions, the FAU reunions. What are the main differences, do you think, with your experience and the FAU during the war?
Well, for a long time I didn't go to any reunions at all. When I did go to one, and I think it was one in Birmingham, I went with another old friend of mine who worked in the post-war service. And so he was, in a way, a sort of link between the wartime people and the international service that I joined. But I certainly formed the impression at that reunion that there were little groups. People who had worked in Africa, people who had worked in India, people who had worked in China, formed very cohesive groups and didn't mix great deal with the rest of us. So, although I think the reunions were a grand idea, they were quite difficult to manage in terms of getting a proper mix of all the members of all the phases of the FAU.
Do you think they have a different status because they were sort of wartime?
Well, it's partly a question of status, I suppose, but more a question of age. There was almost a generation between us and those who'd served in the wartime FAU. This is the thing I find now because I have taken over responsibility for the small charity that looks after former members of the FAU of any of its stages. And I find myself therefore dealing with people who served in the wartime FAU who imagine I know all about what they did, whereas my knowledge is very scanty. But it does give me a better overview of the unit in all its phases.
Do you think it was very different being a non-war situation, though, being a conscientious objector in a situation which wasn't one of war, compared with facing up to, not participating in a war?
Well, you must remember, Lynn, there were other wars going on, and indeed, when I subsequently met some people during my civil service career who were roughly my contemporaries and had done national service around this time, some of them had a very rough time in Korea, yes, national service at that time might have involved working in real war situations.